Welcome to the Stories to Tell podcast, a podcast dedicated to the writing, editing, and design of family history books and memoirs. I am Nancy Barnes, an editor with Stories to Tell. Our podcast today is on publishing journals and letters. Bruce Bothwell knew that his father's journals were a fascinating record of a unique place and time in American history. His father, Ronald Bothwell, had been a hobo in the 1920s, and he took notes. In this audio discussion, Bruce describes how he revised the journals he inherited into a narrative form to make his book interesting and entertaining for readers. Bruce Bothwell is a prolific writer, and he's also gathered his lifelong correspondence with his brother Lynn into a book series called Brothers for Life. He shares his evolution as a writer and his experiences with publishing. You can find his book by typing the title On the Tramp and the author's name, Bothwell, into the search box on Amazon.com. Bruce, tell us about your background as a writer. Was this book a new experience for you?
The book itself was a new experience, but I've been writing for a long time. It all started when I was a sophomore in high school, back in the dark ages. That was 1960. I had no interest in writing at all, but in my sophomore English class, there was a school-wide short story contest, and my sophomore English teacher said, "Hey, why don't you write something?" So I wrote this story, and it won first place in the contest and got printed in the Creative Writing magazine. And Ogden High School had an unbelievably good creative writing teacher. And as when I was a senior, I was able to take that plus another class from him and learned many, many things. And that right there, that spurred me into the idea I would love to be a writer. And from then on, that's exactly what I've done.
Tell me about your father's journals. How did you inherit them? How old were you when the first time you read them?
I was rather old, actually. My father died when I was 10. I had little or no knowledge of any of this stuff. In about 30 years later, I discovered from my mother that he had kept journals when he was a hobo in the 1920s and early 30s. I didn't even know he was that. That was all disguised for me. And she let me borrow those journals, and I just kind of sat on them for a while, and then I read them, and I was amazed. And then my brother wanted them. He got them. He wasn't interested in doing anything with them. But in the back of my head, it was, you know, my dad deserves to have this in print because, first of all, I don't know how he did that. I mean, he was a hobo for 10 years, basically, and he kept these enormous journals of everything. And then he typed them all up, and my mother helped him when he was dying. And then I said, I'm going to turn that into a book that will be something people will want to read. So most of his stuff was just narrative. So I added dialogue and tried to make it more readable, more like a reading experience rather than just a narrative of somebody on a hobo jaunt.
You know, I've, of course, read your father's journals. Or no, I have not read your father's journals. I've read your book, which is very different. And the thing that struck me was that, boy, was he a literate hobo. I mean, he was commenting on books he'd read, movies he'd seen, and, you know, the American scene. He was a fascinating man.
I don't think he was the typical hobo. He would go to a town. He loved to go to movies and to vaudeville and any kind of performance. He would go right to the library if the town had one, and he was a real avid reader. And so he was very knowledgeable. He wasn't what you call the bum, you know. He was an interesting guy.
Those original journals, were they clear? Were they organized?
Yeah, they were all typed up and in chronology, just as he had written them out in these little notebooks that I've got a few of. I don't even know. A lot of times he was scribbling this next to a fire. I don't know how he was able to see to do it. But they were all typed up and fairly readable. First of all, I just retyped them in the computer and made copies of that for my children and my brother. And then I said, hey, let's make this into a better book.
Tell me, what's the difference between it as a journal and a better book? How can you improve a journal to make it a good book?
He didn't have any idea that anybody would be reading any of this stuff. my idea was, well, he's got these people that he's doing this with. Who are they, and why would he interact with them, and how would he interact with them? And so through my imagination, I set up these scenes where he had some reason to be going on these little trips that he started off when he was a late teen. So I thought, you know, there would definitely be this interaction in this dialogue, and people, I think, can relate better to that than they can just, okay, I'm going here.
Well, dialogue is one of the greatest tools of fiction for exactly that reason, because now we get to witness a conversation and people say what they're thinking to one another. It's not all internal. So you added dialogue. He didn't have any dialogue.
If there was any dialogue, it was minimal. Yeah, I added a lot, especially in the first few chapters, to try to get people involved more.
Did you create any fictitious characters? For instance, the boy that he first took off hoboing with, or was that real?
These are all real people.
So do you feel that you fictionalized the dialogue, but you didn't fictionalize his experience at all?
Correct.
Sounds an excellent way to deal with journals. You want to be true to what they really were.
You have to modify things here and there a little bit, but not anything substantial. You know, sometimes here's a little piece of something that doesn't mean anything, so why include it? But for the most part, you know, he was pretty well tuned into the stuff that was worthwhile of what he was doing. And sometimes he would talk about the people he was with, but I thought it was just better for the reader to hear them interacting instead of just saying, well, here's this guy and here's this guy and here's this guy.
So you've done a lot of different kinds of writing. Was this a positive experience for you? I mean, obviously, it's a very personal thing, your father's journals. But as far as a writer's experience, can you tell us a little bit about other kinds of writing you've done and compare them?
Well, I've done a lot of different writing, some of which I've had minimal success at. I started out actually writing poetry in high school and liked what I wrote. And at some point in my life, I decided I'm going to take on a challenge. I don't know if I'll ever make it to the Guinness Book of World Records, but I'm going to write an average of one poem a day for my life. So I've got like 30,000 poems I've written, 29,000 of which are very mediocre, if anything, but a few very good ones. And I've gotten a few published. My very first published one, other than in the high school creative writing journal, was in the Kansas City Star, believe it or not, a really big newspaper in Kansas City. So I've got a few things published poetry-wise. But then other than that, I started, like I said, with the short story, and I wrote stories. And then I expanded into novellas and then into longer novels. Most of what I've written is fiction. I wanted to get things published. And, you know, I wrote to New York and all over to try to get somebody to do something, but couldn't ever really break through. So I said, OK, I'm going to publish my own. So I investigated a little bit without being pretty ignorant. I ended up buying one of these plastic binder machines and making my own thicker cover, doing my own little crappy artwork, and then binding my own little books and start selling them that way. And I sold a few that way. And then finally I got onto the POD scene on the internet and discovered that most of my choices there have been really bad ones, but at least I've got the books, you know, and I've sold a few. I've really never made any money, but I've come close.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit in context of On the Tramp, where you had kind of an unusual project, because your father's set of interests, you know, back in the 20s and 30s would be so different from our time. There's a historical element as well. And I know with creative writing, you know, fiction especially, a lot of what you generate is, you know, from your imagination and from your own life. But to do On the Tramp, did you get into researching at all hobo culture and that period of time and the world he was living in?
Didn't do a lot of research. I've done some since, but for the most part, I was very curious as to who he was interested in, especially anybody that was famous. You know, I wanted to know, was he interested in any of the presidents or any of the famous, the Lindbergh stuff? You know, he mentions a few things here and there, but for the most part, his life was so narrow. It was like, where do I get my next meal? And how am I going to survive this next day? Even when he had jobs, which he did now and then, they were such crappy jobs. And it was, and often he didn't get paid. He worked on that one farm for like over a year, and all they gave him was room and board and kept promising to pay him, but he never got paid.
And one thing that I'll always remember having read the book was a hunger. How if you're hungry, what you think about is food. Like, hunger will shape someone for the rest of their lives. And so you do get an insight in a very direct, you know, experiential way about what his life was like.
You know, I'm planning to take my book to the National Hobo Convention in Britt, Iowa in August. And I'll be curious to see how people react to that.
The people who would attend that event would be fascinated, I am sure. It'd be like kindred spirit, you know, sharing that interest. Now, I want you to talk a little bit about your decision to, you mentioned earlier, print on demand, but, you know, I'm not sure all our listeners really understand what it was you did to use CreateSpace to print your book and put it on Amazon.com. What was the benefit for you to do that compared to the way you were making books before with your, you know, spiral bind punch and printing them up at Kinko's or whatever? Why do the Amazon route?
Well, actually, the first question is, why do the Nancy route? You know, before, they make their money by having the author buy their book. And especially the last one I did, which is Publish America, which has to be the worst of the worst. And they're still chasing me every day now. They're hounding me to my grave, wanting me to buy 6 million books. Some of them are interested in making a fairly decent looking book. And some of my books do look pretty good. Some of them aren't interested in making it look good at all. Now, when I discovered you through my brother, I discovered that you had reason behind doing everything and wanted to make the book not only look good, but be reflective of what it was. So it not only looks good, just as good as any book you can find in a store, but it reflects what the theme and the idea behind the book is. So it's something that a lot of POD people, the publishers online, don't care about. All they're caring about is to finish up the project, charge you a few $100s, and then make you buy as many as you will.
Do you mind sharing with our listeners what the deal was with your contract with Publish America? A lot of people have not ventured into subsidy publishing, so they might not be familiar with how it works.
Well, I only went to Publish America because one of my friends said, you know, the neat thing about this one is it doesn't cost you a penny. So I said, hey, that sounds like a good deal. Then they slap on this 7-year contract that you have where you can't really do anything with your, it's your property, but you can't do anything with it and without their permission.
When you enter into a contract with a publisher, what they're saying is, we're the ones who are going to control how many books are sold, for better or for worse. The way they present it to you is, hey, aren't you lucky that we're going to market your book for you? But if they fail to market your book, then it languishes and you can't go elsewhere because you're locked into your contract with them.
They make it seem as though they are marketing your book. I mean, they've got all these unbelievable ploys that really are fake. The latest one they got now is there's this literary agent that really wants to handle my book. Well, I know that's just crap. They wanted to send my book over to the European Book Fair and stuff like that. I mean, it's just constant. And then the little sidelight is, well, if you'll buy 5 of your books, we'll do that. Well, and what they do is they set the price so high on their website that no one will buy a book. You can buy it cheaper because you can get some, you know, most of the time it's like you buy 5 and we'll give you 10 free, but you're still buying it at that exaggerated price. Right now, the price for my paperback book is, and what is it? It's less than 300 pages, $32.95 plus whatever it is for postage and handling, another $5 or something. I mean, it's just crazy. Nobody would buy a paperback book for that.
Pricing a book is challenging, and one thing is that it has to be relatively inexpensive to produce so that you're not marking it up so much that it is prohibitive from people buying it.
Right. That was the good thing with the CreateSpace and the Amazon experience, was that you know, you can have a price that's fairly reasonable, and then all you got to do is pay a small fee, and then you can get them printed, and you can actually sell them yourself and buy them yourself. And actually, I make far more money if I sell it myself. So I buy a few and sell it to friends and neighbors and relatives and anybody that's interested.
They see that cover price, the full price, and yet you as the author receive it at a very good discount.
And I have many of my books at a local bookstore. And, you know, they get a much bigger cut. They insist on getting 25% of the cover price. So I don't make as much money as if they sell it than if I sell it. But it's out there. You know, it's down. And they've got a little corner for local authors. And it's well displayed.
You know, you've got an incredible accomplishment. How many books have you written?
The ones that I've actually either published myself or had published is 15 right now. But I've got a few others that are pretty well done. And then I've got this series that I'm doing that you're helping with called Brothers for Life. That's pretty well, I've got about 5 volumes of that pretty well done. So
tell our audience about Brothers for Life and what the concept of the series is.
I don't know when it hit me in the head, but my brother and I are both writers and interested to be writers, but we've had a correspondence for many years. He went to the Air Force Academy in 1960, and I was a sophomore in high school. We grew up sibling rivals, maybe enemies, but when he got to the Air Force Academy, I think he was a little lonely. He wrote me a letter, never done that in his life, and I wrote him back, and then he wrote me back, and I wrote him back, and we've been corresponding ever since. So we have 50 years of correspondence, and of course, since the advent of email, a vaster volume than in the old days, I thought, you know, I kept all these letters, and Lynn swore that he kept all his. So when I started with this concept, he dug up all these old letters, and that's what I started with. I said, wouldn't it be interesting to have an epistolary novel? Most people don't know what that is, but there's a history of those that go way back to the 1600s, 1700s. And it's just letters written back and forth between people. But this one is just letters between brothers. So I fictionalized everything because I didn't want to be sued by my ex-wives and things like that, and kind of kept the mainstream of these letters, which in the 60s were not extremely literary, but in the 1970s and on, we had a whole lot of fun with each other and did a lot of joking and a lot of, you know, every once in a while it was serious about family or about sports, but a lot of times it was just kind of screwing around and having a good time with language. And so I said, you know, I started it out, and then I said, hey, I'm just going to take this to the end. I'm going to kill these old guys off eventually, but I've got enough good stuff here for maybe 6-7 volumes.
Letters are so intimate, and you get a really strong sense of life unfolding from letters, you know, as you do from journals. I've enjoyed reading your writing very much, and I think you're a very creative and incredibly prolific writer. Would you have any advice to people, I'm thinking about On the Tramp specifically, and having documents perhaps not written by yourself, your father's journals in this case, would you have any advice to people about a way to manage the project if they were to have raw journals, a method to approach them to bring them around to a book?
I think people need to kind of look at what's my purpose here. If your purpose is strictly to give a history of what I've got and just maintain that religiously and faithfully, then there's not a whole lot you can do. But if you want to make it readable so that people can really enjoy, and it might be just your family, but at least to actually read the stuff instead of just saying, okay, I have this book, it's on a shelf, but I'll never read it because it's that dry stuff that, you know, so-and-so put out. You've got to invest in, is there a lot of duplication? What's the pith? What's the theme? What's the idea behind it all? And do I want to make it more like a book that people would read, which would mean adding dialogue, which would mean to set up scenes from, like, let's say this is a family history. Well, there are significant things that happen in families that are well worth remembering, but they're so much better and funnier and more interesting if you had what the family said and did at the time instead of just, you know, we had a reunion. That's not terribly exciting.
And I think that that's the difference between reporting history or just straight historical documents. If you hand over historical documents to other people, they say, oh, well, those are documents. they don't see it as a reading experience that they're going to relate to. Thank you for joining our program and sharing your wisdom.
I've enjoyed it. You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us for this Stories to Tell podcast. Our podcast is dedicated to the writing, editing, and design of memoirs and family history books. You can get more information about us at storiestotellbooks.com.